From the Gable Media Podcast Network and presented by Lines, this is Spaces, the podcast where we make sense of the spaces that shape society. I'm your host, Demetrius Lynch. Hello, thanks for coming back. And if you're new here, welcome. This is episode 204, where I share insights into why California housing is so expensive. But before we get into today's episode, one housekeeping item. A couple of episodes back, I mentioned that I was developing a guidebook. Well, I'm excited to announce that it is finally available at lines.studio/store. But it's more than a guidebook. It's a strategic, pre-designed framework to help you avoid costly mistakes in common projects like kitchens, ADUs, additions, and small commercial tenant improvements. In it, you'll learn how to define your project scope, what construction projects actually cost in Southern California, how to assemble the right team, what project timelines to expect, and the most common and costly mistakes to avoid. You'll also receive worksheets to guide you through defining your scope, interviewing your design and construction team, planning and tracking your project timeline, assessing your project risk before getting started, and a key element of this whole download that I'm most excited about is a budget planner and calculator. With just a few clicks, you'll have an impressive starting budget that identifies estimated construction costs, design and permit fees, and more. Now, we'll talk about a lot of these things over the coming episodes, but I highly recommend this framework for anybody that's planning a project in the near future. Now, I built this because over the past 20 years, I've found the biggest pain point for owners is ambiguity and uncertainty with the process. No matter how much I try to inform clients about what the process is going to be like in advance, there's ultimately things that just aren't picked up on or are forgotten, and it leads to frustration later down the line. This framework lays out everything you need to know and provides clarity for you to move forward efficiently and with confidence. This was a dream scenario for me where I would want clients to come ready with all of this information absorbed prior to chatting with me, to have a clear understanding of the process and all of its ups and downs. It just makes the experience so much better for everyone involved when there's a clear understanding of expectations. Now, this guide is $149, but it is currently in its soft launch phase at a special price of $89. In addition, I will refund the first 5 purchasers that leave a review or send me one through my contact page, email, or social media. So act fast and go to lines.studio/store. That's lines, lines.studio/store. Or follow the link in the show notes to check it out. Now today, I'm going to share insights into why California housing is so expensive. The topic is coming up a little bit earlier in this series of talks after watching the last few California governor primary debates, and realizing a lot of them are just missing the mark about housing. I take a deep dive into this in my recent series, Built to Divide, so I highly recommend checking that out. It's 12 episodes, and it guides you through the evolution of our housing and affordability issues. I'll add a link to that in the show notes as well, but highly recommend checking that out. But in the meantime, I want to give you a quick crash course of why housing in California is so expensive.
Hi, Demetrius here. As you may know, Spaces is part of Gable Media, the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community and beyond. You may have heard me previously mention the development of a brand new membership platform for Gable Media. Well, it's finally here. You can now sign up to be a member at gablemedia.com/members. And as your first major perk, you gain exclusive access to our continuing education program, including AIA credit-worthy courses. That's right. Gable Media is now an official AIA CES provider, and you can get credit for listening to select Spaces episodes. The days of scouring the internet for online courses and running around town for credit-worthy presentations are over. I've tried out our program, and it is the most convenient way to get your continuing education credits. Now, this membership tier will be limited, so make sure to go to gablemedia.com/members or just click the link in the show notes to gain access today.
So if you ever looked at a renovation quote or new build in California, especially Southern California, and thought, why is it so expensive? You're not alone. I hear this all the time. Two homeowners can do what feels like the same project, one in another state, one here, and the cost difference can be massive. And the assumption is usually contractors are charging more, materials are more expensive, or someone is just inflating numbers because of the location. But in reality, it's much more complex than that and has a storied history, because construction costs in California aren't just about labor and materials. They're shaped by policy, safety standards, infrastructure, and decades of decisions that most people never see or forget about. So the cost of building in California is largely systemic. It's not arbitrary. It's built into the system. And once you understand that, two things happen. The numbers start to make more sense, and you can make better decisions about your own project. Because instead of reacting to costs, you start to understand what's driving it, what's flexible, and what's not. And that distinction is critical. Now let's get into the major drivers of costs. Leading the list, seismic requirements. California sits on multiple active fault lines. That's not new, but what most people don't realize is how much that impacts construction today and how recent safety standards were actually implemented. After major earthquakes like the 1933 Long Beach, 1971 San Fernando, and 1994 Northridge earthquakes, building codes evolved significantly. Today, even relatively simple projects often require structural upgrades, additional framing, shear walls, and foundation reinforcement. And that can add roughly 5 to 15% to construction costs. And importantly, this isn't optional. It's required to meet modern safety standards. Number two, energy compliance, or Title 24. California is one of the most energy-regulated states in the country, and most people don't understand why. This actually dates back to the 1970s. After the oil embargo and the energy crisis that followed, the state implemented what's known as Title 24 energy standards. It requires higher insulation in your walls, higher efficiency windows, higher mechanical system performance, and testing and verification that makes sure all of this works. And the result? California has some of the lowest per capita energy consumption in the country. And to give you a sense of what that means, studies show that total global inputs of primary energy in 2023 was estimated to have been around 604 exajoules. The United States accounted for 96 exajoules, that's 16%. Now, to bring that down to scale and some comparison, per capita, people in the U.S. consumed 285 gigajoules in 2023. People in the rest of the world consume about 75.3 gigajoules. So those in the U.S. are consuming way more energy than everyone else in the world. But for us here in California, we're quite a bit lower than the national average. Californians consume 192 gigajoules. That's 35% less than the average American. Now, it's probably a combination of, one, we have a mild climate, but we've invested a lot into our infrastructure to mitigate energy usage and diversify how we create that energy. But that effort does add about 10 to 20% to upfront construction costs. So again, there's a trade-off. Higher initial costs, but long-term, there's much more efficient energy use. Number three, permits and fees. And when I talk a little bit more about the governor's race later, you'll hear this a lot. But in California, there are tons of fees and development costs that a lot of people talk about as a hindrance in construction and the housing industry. But most people don't understand why and how hard it is to undo and to solve, because people are usually not happy with the solutions. But it's also one of the biggest surprises for homeowners. Now, permit costs in California are not small, and there's a reason for that. Now, after Proposition 13 in the 1970s, property tax revenue became limited. So local governments shifted where they could collect that revenue, because in order to pay for everything, they still have to figure out somewhere else to get those funds. That revenue need shifted to new construction, and renovations became a major source of that funding. So that shows up as plan check fees, permit fees, school impact fees, infrastructure fees, and special assessments like Mello-Roos. And depending on your project, this can easily land in the 3-7% range of construction costs, or significantly higher in some cases. Labor costs. California is also one of the most expensive labor markets in the country, and that's driven by cost of living, housing shortages, labor laws, union structures in some sectors, and policies that have constrained our labor force in a number of ways. And labor is a significant chunk of your construction costs, roughly 14% or more of total construction costs. Complexity and regulation. This is one of two things that people really don't see. And I'll come to the next one in a second. But every project in California involves layers of code compliance, zoning regulations, environmental considerations, review processes. Even something that seems simple on the surface can trigger additional studies, plan revisions, and extended timelines. And time itself is a cost. Now, a lot of people want to just get rid of regulation and cut back as much as possible in this area, but we have to understand there's a balance with all the previous things that I talked about, that some of these things need to have oversight, because there's too much incentive to cut costs and to protect your profit margin and safety standards and some of the other things that we talked about tend to be the first to want to go if there's no regulation protecting those things. And the last one, which is a little bit more complex than the breadth of this conversation goes, but it's the financialization of everything. Funding has significantly changed over time, where banks want either a much bigger payout or guarantee on their return to invest into a project. And because of that, middle-income housing and things like that tend to get squeezed out because there's not as much of a guarantee or payout on the back end of that. So that's why you see this influx of luxury housing, large homes, because there's much what they call penciling out. It guarantees that everyone's going to get paid. There's going to be a good profit margin for both the builder and the financier behind the project. And again, this is, I'm just giving you like a very truncated explanation here, but the financial system has completely changed over the last 50, 60 plus years, which has had a great impact on the types of projects that get funded. And on the back end, loans and the ability to leverage has also increased the pricing of homes. I highly recommend you check out Build to Divide, because it gets much more in depth of all of these nuances. And I'm afraid I'm going to go spiral if I get too far into it today. But check that out for more. Now let's pivot and quickly talk about the leading candidates, housing platforms, and share a little bit of reality around what they're proposing. Now I'm going to go through these kind of in what the latest, as of today, polls show of their ranking. So first we have Steve Hilton. He sees the problem in housing as kind of what I was just talking about. We're building homes that are too big, not the homes for middle class, and then fees, mandates, and requirements.
The right answer is my plan, which was the first plan that I put forward in this campaign. Number one, we have to end this outrageous hidden tax on housing. They call it impact fees. It can add up to 20% to the cost of a home. Secondly, we have to reduce the extreme environmental regulations that make it 3 or 4 times as expensive to build the exact same home in California as in neighboring states. Number three, we have to end the exploitative union lawsuits that are filed to block housing that extract project labor agreements that make the cost so much higher. And number four, we have to end the war on single family homes so that we can build the housing we need for young families. We need more starter homes in California.
His plan is to first make starter homes more profitable to build, reducing or deferring fees for entry-level homes, aligning fees with home size instead of flat charges, allow fees to be financed over time instead of paid up front, eliminate state income tax on profits tied to qualifying starter home construction. Now, these are some interesting ideas. However, as we'll get to in a second, I don't think they're possible because of he's also going to cut a ton of taxes. So I don't know how you would pay for these things without the revenue to make them happen. Two, he wants to fast track starter home projects, create a fast track approval process for projects that include starter homes, and something that's called by right. A few of the candidates have referenced this, some not by name, but by right is basically saying that if you meet all of the rules, the zoning codes, construction codes, you should be able to fly through permitting with no issues, no pushback, and have no opportunity for neighbors to complain or stop the project. Now, while this sounds great, I'm not quite sure that it would solve the problem. I think there's still going to be a challenge to get financing for these types of projects. Two, I think that there's also an issue of capacity to review and approve projects. So I think some of those things need to be shored up in order for this to actually be effective. I'm going to run through the next two because I think they jointly work together with my response. But he wants to enforce accountability, create a governor's housing expediter to unblock stalled approvals, require cost-benefit review of recent mandates, prevent new layers of requirements that drive up construction costs, and then four, wants to stop adding costs, have a five-year freeze on housing regulations, require cost-benefit review of recent mandates, prevent new layers of requirements that drive up construction costs. Now, in this area, he starts to kind of remind me of Governor Schwarzenegger, who really wanted to peel back all regulations and cut costs as much as possible. And I don't know that it's actually effective because there's so many safety standards for a reason. But let's say you were to do that. There's potential for so many errors and so many issues with liability because of all of these lapses in oversight and execution. We would build really quick, and they would have tons of homes with leakage issues, mold, and all sorts of other things. So if we were to actually peel back all of these regulations, I don't know that it would be a good thing for housing down the line. And remember, Schwarzenegger had a similar buzz. He was elected in a special recall election to replace Governor Gray Davis in 2003. He was reelected in 2006, but by 2009, his approval rating matched that of Gray Davis, a dismal 27%. The disapproval was primarily due to unpopular budget cuts that led to minimal change in the budget deficit, high unemployment, failing schools, and overcrowded prisons, to name a few. Then he upset conservatives after ultimately implementing a tax hike. Number five, expand starter homes in existing neighborhoods. Expand incentives for building and selling ADUs, create financial tools to lower upfront costs for buyers, encourage smaller, more affordable units within existing communities. This I agree with. We've done a lot of this already, so be happy to see this kind of thing continue. Number six, create a starter home loan program. Wants to create a state-backed starter home loan program for first-time homebuyers purchasing qualifying starter homes, allow assistance for down payments, closing costs, or interest buy-downs, structure the program as a deferred second loan repaid upon sale or refinance, tie the program directly to newly built starter homes to increase supply, not just demand. Now, I think this would be great. However, the rub is that Steve also wants to do no state income tax on the first $100,000 for all Californians, no tax on tips, no small business tax, and then a flat 7.5% above $100,000 income. And doesn't mention anything about Prop 13. So I have no idea where the money would come from to increase all of the government employees that would be needed to expedite and process permitting and all of those things, as well as provide all of these programs and just function normally. I just have no idea. I don't see how this is possible. Some components sound good, but I don't think it's possible. Xavier Becerra, he sees the problem as not building enough homes.
Well, we have to give those who build the homes the incentive to do so. That means streamlining the regulations and the fees that make it impossible to believe that they can make these projects pencil out. Once we do that, we want to build smart. We want to build in the places where it makes sense. By transportation, so it's easy to get to and from work. Make it so that we don't have commutes that are hour and a half long. We want to make sure that we help those who want to buy a house get in a house. Most Californians who are renting are essentially paying a monthly mortgage, except it's called rent. I would convert them into homeowners by helping them with their down payment. We have down payment assistance programs where we will expand the opportunity for a renter to become a homeowner. And the next thing I will do is in the first 100 days, I will make sure that we get all those projects that are essentially shovel ready, ready to go. And there are some 40,000 housing units that are shovel ready. They just need a little kick over the finish line. I would make sure we do that, whether it's the small tranche of money they need or getting rid of some of the licensing requirements they need.
His plan is to increase housing production, cutting unnecessary red tape, speeding up approvals for projects that meet affordability and environmental standards, and reducing unnecessary costs. This all sounds good. Being on the ground and experiencing a permit process, I'm not quite sure how much fluff there is to really cut. A lot of it is necessary to ensure that the homes, buildings are built with proper safety standards in mind. To me, it seems like a capacity issue in order to review and process things in a timely manner. There's just not enough employees to do so. From my experience, that seems to be more of the issue. In large scale projects, the other issues that I see are dealing with neighborhoods to get approval. And the big one really is CEQA challenges that people tend to run into, which is a whole nother thing that needs to be addressed and kind of cleaned up. Again, in Built to Divide, you'll hear a more detailed explanation, but CEQA has been sort of wielded as a tool not in line with what it was initially intended to be. So CEQA definitely needs to be cleaned up. But to me, it seems like more of a capacity issue that a lot of candidates don't necessarily seem to touch on. Number two, enforce the California Tenant Protection Act. This is just an existing law to protect renters. And one other thing that I thought was interesting was that, at least from what he says, he has a background in construction and his family's in construction. So I thought that was something that stood out from all the other candidates. His action plan for housing was actually pretty light, but he does have governance experience, so I feel pretty neutral about him as a candidate in this regard of housing. Tom Steyer, he also sees the problem as not building enough homes.
Look, the biggest problem in California is that Californians can't afford to live here, and the number one problem there is housing. And I've seen people who have full-time jobs who are still having to live in their car. But if we're going to solve the housing problem, and I've said we'll build 1 million units, it's not a silver bullet the way some of these people are suggesting. It's silver buckshot. Yes, we have to shorten permitting and make it less expensive. We made a first step on it last year. We'll make more. Two, we have to redo zoning so that we build denser and around public transportation. Three, We need to actually drop the cost per square foot of building. There are ways to do it. Industrial construction away from site and then putting it together on the site drops the cost per square foot by a third. And lastly, one of the biggest reasons it's hard to build houses here is the cities and counties don't want it because they can't afford to take care of the people who are in the houses. I've said on day one, I'll call for a special election to close a corporate tax loophole. That will fund it. That will get the cities and counties on our side. The realtors are mad at me. They're fighting me. But that's the only way we drive down housing costs for the people of California. Mr. Steyer.
He had a more extensive plan of action that I think he touches on a little bit more of understanding of all the things that I laid out earlier. One, he wants to make building easier by financing projects using public dollars, state financing, and incentives, bring certainty and speed to construction, embracing density by right projects, and converting existing office buildings to mixed use and mixed income housing. He also wants to slash fees and taxes and accomplish that by transferring that cost through the closing of a loophole tax break for commercial property owners. Two, he wants to invest in building innovation to bring them to scale. If you're a frequent listener, you know there's tons of innovations in the building industry for construction, how to deliver projects more efficiently, tech, actual methods. There's so much out there, but this is the biggest problem, is there's no investment to really bring them to scale to the level that we need to unleash all of this affordable housing. So I really like this idea of the state getting behind it and investing in these tools and techniques. So really excited to see that. Also, he wants to invest into ADUs. Number three, promote innovation at state agencies. Now here he does acknowledge the capacity issue, but he wants to address it through innovation. Not quite sure in my experience. Just throwing technology at your staff doesn't always make things more efficient. So I'm not quite sure how effective that's going to be. I think to address this, there's going to have to be a combination of both hiring and technology and innovating processes. But he doesn't get specifically into it. So maybe he's thinking all of those. But I like that he does address the issue of capacity. Number four, families ahead of Wall Street. Expand first look home ownership programs, policies that put home buyers ahead of corporate investors, and if needed, enforcing anti-monopoly laws to prevent firms from buying homes after disasters like the recent fires in Altadena and Palisades. I really like that he's acknowledging this issue. And one of the things that is really, that has had an effect, not just here in California, but across the country, is this Wall Street infusion into our housing market. I believe he's maybe one of two, if not the only one, that has acknowledged this. So that's good to see. And for, number five, enforce Tenant Protection Act. Again, same as Becerra. Number six, resiliency program. He wants to implement a resiliency program where all homeowners can upgrade their homes for climate change. So that's going to be insulating walls, changing out windows and doors, upgrading to efficient lighting and appliances and those sorts of things. And his plan is to pay for it by the worst polluters. I don't know how you would do that. Maybe it's some sort of tax, I'm not sure, but that is his pitch. And on the back end of that, the hope is that it will address insurance issues and kind of bring insurers back who are leaving because their risk makes the rate too high for buyers to afford. And then seven, expand interim housing options. So that's people that are at risk of losing their home, or coming off of being unhoused, they have another place, options to go. Chad Bianco, very, very, very light on policy.
We're going to all be honest about the problem. The problem is California state government. California state government created this housing problem. It is not that we can't afford a house. It's that builders can't afford to build a house because of the over excessive regulations on our building industry, along with every other business and industry in California. On day one, I remove all of those regulations from our building industry that will allow more, as much as a third, sometimes more depending on location, to a third of the price of a home to be removed off of that $900,000 price tag just by getting rid of the government red tape. Instead of 3 to 5 years, it's going to take 3 to 5 months to build a house. We will encourage our builders to build. When we take the restrictions away, builders build homes. We do not have a land problem in California. We have a management problem. We have a government problem that we absolutely must take away. The restrictions, the big ones, all the regulations, but CEQA, Coastal Commission, CARB, all of those on our building and building industry will be removed.
His two-point plan, one, streamline permitting and efficiency, expedite approval for housing projects, eliminate CEQA, incentivize developers to build across California, in the overregulation of our building industry. And two, affordability. Oppose any effort to weaken Prop 13, eliminating overregulation. Again, just cutting regulation willy-nilly, I don't think is a good move. And I also don't think that it addresses the issues that we actually have. So I think you're going to end up taking on a lot of risk with no actual solution to our housing issues. And again, we saw this after Governor Schwarzenegger. He approached it the same way, and it didn't solve anything. Katie Porter, she sees the problem as speed. Again, pretty light.
Housing is personal to me. I've sat across from thousands of Californians who are facing eviction or foreclosure. When I served the state of California for 3 years under then Attorney General, now former Vice President Kamala Harris, and I held the big banks' feet to the fire for predatory lending. I've also questioned CEOs of big banks about how the huge slice that housing takes out of their paycheck. Housing has been my number one issue since I launched this race, and I have the deepest background in housing policy of any candidate on this stage. The key is to build faster. If we built at the same speed in California as states like Colorado, we could take 10 or 20% off the cost of housing. That's real money back in families' pockets. It's not a couple bucks, it's hundreds of dollars.
She just wants to build faster, enforce prompt issuance of certificate of occupancies. I rarely see an issue where there's a delay to issue a certificate of occupancy, unless there's actual issues that are not being met in the field. So that means there's core issues with the building, whether it's plumbing, electrical, mechanical, anything like that, where the building can't operate properly. Where a certificate of occupancy is delayed. Those are usually the issues that I see, so I'm not quite sure that just enforcing a prompt issuance solves anything. If it doesn't work, you can't open it. Stop local delays, innovate in construction techniques, land and infrastructure investment. This was all pretty light in a plan. So can't really make a judgment call necessarily, but as far as housing plans go, it's pretty lacking. Matt Mahan, he has a much more extensive plan. He sees the problem as it being too hard and too expensive to build.
In San Jose, we were approving thousands of housing units, 20,000 housing units over the last 7 years or so that weren't getting built. I led us through a process of looking at the data and recognizing that we in government are often in the way. We did hard things. We sped up permitting. We've used new technology to make it easier to apply. And most importantly, we reduced one-time fees that look good on paper, but we're blocking the very thing we need, housing and opportunity for people. We now have thousands of new units under construction. That's a template for the state. That's how we'll move forward. I know what's at stake. I grew up in a household that was paycheck to paycheck. I remember my family, my parents arguing about how to make the mortgage payment. Solving this problem is the most fundamental way to expand economic opportunity and upward mobility in California, and I will get the job done.
Number one, he wants to do a 2-year tax break on new housing. So my read on this, it sounds like he wants to put a hold on all state and local taxes on new homes and any fees. That's going to be a massive hit to state and local budgets for infrastructure and just operations. So I'm not quite sure where he's going to close that gap. And depending on the size of the project, the design and permitting process can be quite extensive. Some take more than a couple years for large-scale projects, take longer than a couple years to really unfold. So I'm not quite sure how much benefit there's going to be in this. And I don't believe he proposes any new taxes to cover this hit to budgets across the state. Number two, cut regulatory delays. He wants to require transparency from all local mayors to report the status of projects with public dashboards for permits. This actually seems counterintuitive and more cumbersome, because most jurisdictions either have these public dashboards or you can easily call and kind of get a status report on your project. So I'm not quite sure there's benefit to that. Process permits within 30 days. For small scale projects, I think this would be doable and amazing. However, for large scale projects, I would almost say this is impossible unless you increase the staff quite dramatically. And even still, I don't know that you could throw a lot of people onto one project and make it go any faster. It'll be a little bit too many cooks in the kitchen to make the process efficient. Even with cutting a lot of regulation, I'm not quite sure that you could get a large-scale project approval down to 30 days. I think dramatic efforts to squeeze this kind of stuff down to very small windows is just going to increase risk. And unfortunately, I think it's going to ultimately be the who ends up owning it last that absorbs all of that risk. Allow third-party plan reviewers. A lot of cities do implement this. If there is a backlog, they'll hire out to a third party. But it kind of sounds like he's saying that a builder could choose to circumvent a city to do a third-party plan review, which I'm not opposed to necessarily, but then you get into issues that we saw in the financial industry where people were paying third-party reviewers for rubber stamps, and then there were all sorts of issues that unfolded in the 2008 crash around that. I would be cautious about this idea if it's not directly connected to whatever the local jurisdiction is. Three, industrialized housing. Again, this is similar to Steyer, which I really love this idea. But Matt Mahan wants to fast-track factory-built homes, financial incentives for new factories, statewide standards for prefab housing. We have a lot of prefab housing that gets state approval. But I like this idea of standards that the state can provide as a starting point, which would make the whole process a lot faster for companies to design to, and incentivize industrial housing for state-funded projects. Number four, rationalize building codes. There are areas of the building code that could go through some analysis and reevaluation, but to my understanding, this is done quite frequently, so I'm not sure that this adds anything new, but never opposed to relooking at things to make sure that we have the most efficient processes. Number five, reform laws that allowed frivolous lawsuits against builders of condominiums. I'm not going to get into that because it's a much more detailed area than I can go in this conversation. Comprehensive housing workforce strategy. I really love this idea. He wants to bring back technical education in high school and incentivize partnerships between college, labor unions, and construction firms. We veered off of this for, I don't know why, for some strange reason, but I really would love for us to re-embrace this kind of strategy for our workforce, especially in the housing workforce. Number seven, he wants local governments to be able to keep a portion of the new tax revenue from new housing in their area and then use that money to acquire new affordable housing. Now, I like this because it'll tighten up the turnaround and make things much more efficient as far as addressing affordable housing within each city. It would just be a matter of staying on top of each jurisdiction that they're using that money for affordable housing, which is going to be a whole nother layer of oversight at the state level to follow up with all of these various jurisdictions. Number eight, he wants to address the insurance issues, similar to Tom Steyer, with resiliency programs and forest management. I think he's the only one that I saw that addressed forest management for the most part, but that is another issue with insurance. Number nine, a one-stop shop for state grant programs for affordable housing, because I believe there are multiple outlets that developers have to go to. So he's trying to bring that all under one roof, which I actually believe is happening right now. So he wants to extend that, possibly expand how that program works. Number 10, acquire affordable housing units. So he wants the state to actually use funds to buy like unused hotels and office buildings or whatever unused buildings that are out there to create affordable housing units. From every study that I've heard or experts, this tends to be the most cost-efficient way to address this issue rather than building new structures. Number 11, incentivize ADUs. Pretty self-explanatory. Number 12, work to protect and expand Section 8. Section 8 is a national program that provides affordable housing that by basically closing the gap between market price and what the resident can afford. The country used to provide affordable housing units, and then that stopped, and then they replaced it with this Section 8. And that's been weakened over time, and some are trying to get rid of it completely. So Matt Mahan is the only one that has mentioned this that I've seen. So he wants to try to protect and expand Section 8. But as a single state governor, I'm not quite sure how much leverage you have. So that's a little bit of an empty note, but glad to see that he wants to support it. And number 13, introduce and expand a home sharing program. So this is the first that I've heard of it, but he mentioned the San Diego proposal for the Home Sharing Act of 2025. And the idea was for empty nesters, people that just had extra bedrooms, could rent them out. But the income from that rental could be exempt from taxes. So that's where this kind of comes from. It's interesting, but I'm not quite sure how effective that would be. I could see if you could get some additional tax benefit for doing it, but I would imagine most people that are open to renting a bedroom probably do so and just don't claim the income. So I'm not quite sure how effective this would be. So that was a quick rundown of the top five candidates at the moment in the California governor's race. Again, this was something that jumped out to me recently while I was watching some of the debates and happened to coincide with what I was trying to do with this conversation. So I wanted to share my thoughts about the race in comparison to some of the reasons our costs are so high here in California. And ultimately, it's not by accident. It's by design. It's in the system. And that system reflects safety, energy efficiency, environmental impact, and infrastructure funding. So any adjustments proposed by any of these governors are going to impact all of these various priorities that we have established one way or another. So if you'll be voting, I hope you will. take all of these sorts of things into account, not just for housing, but across the board. But bringing this back home to how it affects you, this doesn't mean that your projects have to spiral out of control. You don't have to be bogged down with why is this so expensive on a macro level. Just kind of focus on which parts of the cost can you actually influence. Because not everything is flexible, but some things are. For example, your finish level, so cabinets, what type of countertops, flooring, those types of things. Your scope clarity, this is a big one, and we'll touch on this on the next episode, but understanding what your scope is going to be key. And then your decision-making process. This is where you have an opportunity to make your project as efficient as possible. Like I mentioned before, time is a cost. So the right and efficient decisions are going to be key. These are the areas where you can actually control your immediate outcomes. Now, a last reminder, if you are planning a construction project, especially here in Southern California, understanding all these sorts of things upfront is one of the most important things you can do. Because once you understand what's driving the costs, you can stop reacting to the numbers and start making informed decisions. And that's exactly why I created Before You Build. It breaks down real cost ranges, what drives those costs, and how to approach your project with clarity. If you're even thinking about building or renovating, I highly recommend you start there. Thank you for listening today. We'll talk again on the next one. Thanks. Thanks for listening. Spaces is brought to you by Lines, my Southern California-based architecture and creative studio that provides services focused on custom homes, home renovations, creative office, and specialty retail spaces. Find out more at lines.studio. That's lines.studio. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question about the built environment or just want to share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. Looking for similar content? Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, and that's gablemedia.com. And lastly, before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content from this episode, visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.